That lines, Iran's lead delegate in Vienna talks says his country will implement the 2015 nuclear deal once Washington removes all sanctions mentioned in the accord or imposed after its withdrawal. India registers a record single day of over 360,000 new cases of the coronavirus as its death toll surpasses the grim milestone of 200,000. And civil society organizations criticize new plans by the European Commission to deport hundreds of thousands of refugees from the EU. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Iran says there are still major differences with the U.S. on who should come back to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal first. After meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate says there are still big challenges ahead. Tom Olesky reports from the Austrian capital.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead. As diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the U.S.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the U.S. should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of U.S. sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Omar Lezgi, Vienna.
Iran's president says the Israeli regime was behind last year's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq.
The martyrdom of General Soleimani was the handiwork of Zionists. It is right that the one who ordered his assassination was Trump, but it was Israel which was behind it all and provoked Washington to kill a senior general who sacrificed his life to serve the interests of the region.
President Rouhani said General Soleimani was fighting Daesh when the terrorist group posed a threat to holy sites in Iraq, as well as the capital, Baghdad. Elsewhere in his remarks, the president said the U.S., Israel, and some reactionary state in the region hatched plots against Iran to deal a blow to the country, but to no avail. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a retaliatory drone attack on an airbase in Saudi Arabia's southwestern province of Asir. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said a Qasif 2K drone targeted the King Khalid base in the city of Khamis Mushaid. The spokesman noted that the attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege against its southern neighbor. Riyadh and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. In the past months, they are pushing for the lifting of the blockade on Yemen and an end to the war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis. A prominent Lebanese composer has reportedly been arrested by Saudi authorities upon arrival in the kingdom. Reports say Samir Safir was in Saudi Arabia at the invitation of a Saudi Information Ministry official. The Lebanese Foreign Ministry has contacted the Saudi embassy in Beirut over the issue, but the Saudi authorities have refused to respond to the requests for information. Saudi authorities have also refused to allow Safir's wife to meet him. Other reports say Safir was arrested a week ago after his residence was raided by Saudi security agents. They say he was then taken to a prison in the country's west. Safir is a vocal supporter of Lebanese President Michel Aoun, and has voiced support for Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. India posts yet another double record of coronavirus infections and deaths amid severe shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff. The health ministry has registered nearly 361,000 new cases. That's the largest single-day total in the world. Some 3,300 people also died of the virus in the past 24 hours. As India's total fatality surpassed the 200,000 mark, this is while experts believe the official tally vastly underestimates the actual toll. In the world's second most populous country, India's COVID-19 crisis is blamed on a new virus variant, as well as mass political and religious events. The crisis has overwhelmed hospitals with dire shortages of beds, drugs, and oxygen. Brazil's Senate has launched an inquiry into the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, promising an impartial investigation.
It was not by chance of the divine scourge that brought us to this situation. There are those responsible, of course. There are responsible for action or omission, negligence or incompetence, and they, if proven, will be held accountable.
The focus of the inquiry will be on the missteps of President Jair Bolsonaro's government, including downplaying the pandemic and promoting ineffective treatments. The delays in securing vaccines, as well as the removal of three health ministers during the pandemic, are among the issues to be investigated. The country has reported more than 72,000 new cases and over 3,000 deaths in the past 24 hours. Brazil is the world's second worst hit country in terms of deaths, with more than 395,000 fatalities. U.S. police are accused of shooting an African-American man at point blank. Earlier, we discussed police violence and racial profiling in the U.S. during our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Now, the attorneys for a family of an African-American man, Andrew Brown Jr., who was fatally shot by North Carolina police last Wednesday, say that he was, quote, executed.
This, in fact, was a fatal wound to the back of Mr. Brown's head as he was leaving the site trying to evade being shot at by these particular law enforcement officers who we believe did nothing but a straight-out execution.
Lawyers said the 42-year-old man suffered four gunshot wounds to his right arm and a fatal shot to the back of his head as he drove away from Elizabeth City officers there. Police said that they're trying to serve Brown with a search and arrest warrants for drug-related offenses. FBI has opened a civil probe into this shooting. Man's death has led to six nights of protests in Elizabeth City. Anger is boiling in the U.S. over a growing number of incidents of police violence and racially charged conduct against the African-American community. And joining us now for the program is Colin Campbell, Press TV correspondent, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Danny Shaw, professor at City University of New York, joining us out of New York. Gentlemen, I want to welcome you both to the program. Colin, obviously, we're going to start with you to get the latest with respect to Andrew Brown's case there.
He was shot, and it was almost like an execution style. And when we talk about that, we've seen videos of militias and movies, perhaps, where people are told to kneel down and they're shot in the back of the head, what's called execution style. And I think what family members are doing is comparing the way that Brown was killed in his car because he was shot in the back of the head. And protesters are incensed. Of course, we are paying attention more to the relationship between police and the black community. also the brown community and other minority communities, but particularly when it comes to the black community, we've seen a number of deaths over the past couple years. Of course, the one reaching the most attention would be George Floyd. And what we're seeing is a call for police reform more than we have ever. We are seeing some pushback. One of the big issues is qualified immunity, which is the way that police are able to avoid civil prosecution if something very bad were to happen during an arrest, like a death, like a maiming, that the qualified immunity protects the police when that happens, and many are saying that that needs to end. Also, connecting pensions, police pensions, to civil cases. They believe, the proponents of these, the reforms of these policies believe, if qualified immunity was taken away or severely decreased, if these wrongful deaths were connected to police pensions, there would be a decrease of these violent incidents where you have police killing unarmed black men, sometimes black women, and other unarmed people.
Thank you, Colin. And Danny Shaw, I want to welcome you to the program there, bud. Your initial thoughts on this?
This is another horrific case of wanton police violence, brutality. In the words of Reverend William Barber, a search warrant or a warrant for someone's arrest is not a license to kill. But all too often, in the case of Andrew Brown, as we saw, and in so many other cases across this country, it's guns ablaze when it's about young black men, unarmed. And the police, as Colin was pointing out, continue to feel invincible and untouchable. They continue to walk through our communities, through oppressed communities, and they're not treated like an everyday person. So they can kill at will, they can humiliate, they brutalize, as happens on a daily basis across this country, and they have no fear of any repercussions. But things in 2021 have changed. It was only a week ago that Derek Chauvin was finally found guilty, and I think that sent shockwaves through the rank and file of police departments across this country, that they're not as invincible as they were a week ago. And that's thanks to a movement of millions and millions, not just here in the United States, but across the world, against state violence.
And Colin, that's the thing, to Danny's point, with respect to the George Floyd case, all the protests, the movements, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, to address this very pressing issue of disproportionate police violence against people of color. My question to you, why are the cops not, showing any kind of transparency in this case, which is really just more so upsetting the black, the white, the brown, the every community you could think of, including the Brown's family members?
Well, most of the time it's because they haven't had to and they don't want to. If they show transparency, it would definitely, in many cases, show a level of guilt right off the bat, which is why we got as far as we did with the George Floyd case. Imagine, just for a second, if that case, there was no video. If there was no video, it was just the word of Derek Chauvin and a bunch of random witnesses, and obviously not George Floyd. So we've seen this type of scenario time and time again where police are acquitted, there's a hung jury, because there's no direct evidence. It's all because of that young woman's video evidence that this case went as far as it did and we saw an actual prosecution of a police officer. Although we know this is not the first time that a police officer wrongfully killed an unarmed black man or wrongfully killed anyone. I mean, this is, again, a pattern that we have seen. Also, we've seen this being protested in other countries like the UK, where there have been other deaths from police officers by the hands of police officers. So, again, we are seeing a more united movement. Some would argue that very recently we have seen a very increased campaign against violence against Asians, and that was pretty universal. But then you didn't see many Asians talking about the defense of unarmed black men when they're killed by police. But that's perhaps another conversation. What we are seeing is an increased interest. That could be because of COVID-19. Many of us are trapped inside. We're captivated by what's on the screen. And more understanding as Black Lives Matter has picked up a more vociferous tone.
All right, gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Colin Campbell there out of Washington, D.C., and Danny Shaw there joining us from New York. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Plans by the European Commission to deport hundreds of thousands of refugees from the EU are met with criticism from civil society organizations. EU's Coast Guard agency Frontex is accused of using aggressive tactics to prevent refugees from reaching the bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU's controversial border and Coast Guard agency Frontex is on course to receive greater power to deport up to 500,000 refugees who have had their applications for asylum in the EU rejected. Frontex is under investigation over allegations that it has aggressively pushed back refugees trying to reach the 27-country bloc.
The European agency always have to comply with fundamental rights. And I don't think that it's right to accuse that Frontex is not doing that. And if there are shortcomings in Frontex, they have to be addressed.
The European Commission has just launched its so-called voluntary return and reintegration strategy. The European Trade Union Confederation and several rights groups say it's all about border control, deterrence, detention and deportation of refugees.
Let's have a common asylum policy between EU member states, put it into practice, and then we see where we are. Certainly, this is not going to stop.
Just last week, 130 refugees drowned after their dinghy capsized in the Mediterranean as they attempted to reach the EU. Frontex vessels didn't get to the scene on time. The situation is not good for those who do make it to the bloc. More than 20,000 refugees are currently trapped on Greek and Spanish islands. Those include children, pregnant women, and people with mental health problems. They are surviving in trailers and tents and have limited access to essential services, including water. EU countries have made it clear they don't want to house refugees. Denmark is pushing ahead with plans to deport Syrians back to their war-torn country. Rights groups say this is astonishing given the role the West played in practically destroying the Arab Republic. Aid agencies say the EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and African countries to prevent refugees from trying to seek asylum here. This as the EU is being forced to defend the actions of its own agencies.
We will not accept this Frontex bashing that comes so cheap.
Rights groups say the EU continues to breach the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which obliges the bloc to protect asylum seekers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A recent United Nations report said 2020 was one of three hottest years on record, marked by wildfires, droughts, floods, and melting glaciers, prompting the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres to say the world stands on the verge of the abyss. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Agence France-Presse news agency. The piece is titled "New Study Shows Doomsday Climate Tipping Points Have Wiggle Room." Please stay with us for more of the Agence France-Presse article. Researchers have calculated global warming thresholds that could tip massive ice sheets into irreversible melting, or see the Amazon rainforest shrivel into savanna. But they're saying they're grace periods, giving humanity more time to draw down planet warming carbon dioxide emissions. More than a dozen tipping points triggered mainly by rising temperatures could unleash catastrophic changes in the Earth's climate system. Scientists said, as the Paris Climate Accord goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius cap above pre-industrial levels slips out of reach, this is potentially very good news, although no reason to relax. Ice sheets atop Greenland and West Antarctic hold enough frozen water to lift oceans a dozen meters or 40 feet, drowning cities and redrawing the planet's coastlines. Greenhouse gases escaping from Siberian permafrost could overwhelm already belabored efforts to curb man-made carbon pollution. Monsoon rains in South Asia, the polar ice cap, coral reef ecosystems, the jet stream, the Amazon basin, all are vulnerable to point-of-no-return transitions that would radically alter the world as we know it today. Up to now, scientists have focused mostly on temperature thresholds and timing. How much warming will it take to trigger each tipping point? Experts are saying the threshold for the two ice sheets to melt is probably below 2 degrees Celsius and may have already been passed. However, to melt the permafrost in Siberia, it will likely take at least another degree or two of global warming. But new research led by Paul Ritchie and Peter Cox from the School of Engineering, Mathematics and Physical Sciences at Exeter University in England asks a different question. Once a tipping point tripwire has been triggered, can we row back by lowering temperatures, whether by sucking carbon dioxide out of our air or injecting a sunscreen into the stratosphere? Peter Cox, senior author of a study published recently in Nature, told Agence France-Presse, "Our analysis shows that it is possible to overshoot tipping point thresholds without leading to an abrupt and permanent climate change, as long as the overshoot is for a short period of time." He added, "There is a period of grace once the threshold is crossed when it is still possible to avoid tipping." In the study, Peter Cox and colleagues looked at four parts of the climate system: the ice sheets, monsoon rains, the Amazon basin, and the ocean conveyor belt of currents that drives cold and warm water across the globe, known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. Ice sheets and ocean currents, they found through modeling, have slow onset tipping points which unfold on a timescale of centuries. This suggests that even if temperatures rise above the tipping point threshold and set in motion a profound change, there is still time to pull back from the cliff's edge by lowering the global thermometer. Peter Cox said, "The slow time scale of some of the most worrying tipping points gives us a better chance of reversing global warming before we tip into a less favorable world." But the researchers found the same timing does not apply to the Amazon rainforest dieback and disruption of the monsoon rains in Asia, which could flip into a new state within decades. For the Amazon, that shift is also hastened by massive deforestation. William Collins, a professor of meteorology at the University of Reading in England, commented, "The study shows that if temperatures overshoot the tipping point for too long, we may set in place irreversible changes in the climate system, such as dying of the Amazon rainforest." Other scientists not involved in the research agreed with the findings, but cautioned against complacency. Grant Allen, a professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Manchester, told the London-based Science Media Centre, "This may offer a very tiny bit of wiggle room in our expectations of when such dire climate shifts might become permanent and extremely damaging as Earth continues to warm." He added, "But a brief delay to some of global warming's more catastrophic consequences does not mean that it is any less dangerous now." A recent United Nations report says 2020 was one of the three hottest years on record, marked by wildfires, droughts, floods, melting glaciers, prompting the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, to say the world stands on the verge of the abyss. The report by the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, said in a double blow to millions hit by the extreme climate events, lockdown restrictions linked to the global coronavirus pandemic also delayed crucial assistance in some regions. The State of the Global Climate Report confirms its preliminary findings, including on land and ocean temperatures, and comes ahead of a US-led summit where Washington will seek to restore its credibility on climate change through fresh pledges. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Reuters news agency, "We are on the verge of the abyss. We're seeing record levels in tropical storms, in the melting of ice sheets or glaciers, in relation to drought and heat waves and wildfires." The report showed the global average temperature in 2020 was about 1.2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial period, ranking it somewhere in the top three hottest years on record, alongside 2016 and 2019, despite cooling La Niña conditions. A World Meteorological Organization spokeswoman said it was too close to make a call between them because of the margin of statistical error. Among the indicators heightened were record low Arctic sea ice extents in 2 months of 2020. Around 80% of the ocean experienced at least one marine heat wave last year. The United States saw both the largest wildfires ever and the most hurricanes making landfall. Hurricane Laura alone, which hit Louisiana on 27th of August last year, caused $19 billion worth of damage and economic losses. The report said Death Valley in California also recorded the world's highest known temperature for at least 80 years of 54.4 degrees Celsius, that is 129.9 degrees Fahrenheit, in August of last year. Measures designed to curb the spread of COVID-19 delayed assistance after Cyclone Harold, one of the strongest storms ever seen in the South Pacific Ocean, and after Cyclone Wongfong in the Philippines, where social distancing rules meant residents could not be evacuated in large numbers.
The Debate.
Hello and warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A prominent international rights group says that Israel's persecution of Palestinians amounts to crimes against humanity and also crimes of apartheid. Human Rights Watch cites instances of Israel's apartheid policies as restrictions on the Palestinians' movement and the seizure of their land for illegal settlement building. The rights group has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute Israeli officials over the persecution of Palestinians. The court has said it will investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Before that, let's get an update from Mona Candila Ramallah about the situation in the occupied lands and also the Palestinians' exposure to Israel's crimes of apartheid. Mona, over to you.
Well, the Palestinians welcomed the Human Rights Watch report on Israeli crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. It urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the Israeli officials implicated in the crimes against the humanity of apartheid. It also said that this Human Rights Watch report is considered as a powerful testament to the struggle of the Palestinian people under the Israel's belligerent military occupation. But at the same time, the Israelis considered this report as claims of both perspicuous as well as false. Israeli foreign minister accused the Human Rights Watch of harboring an anti-Israeli agenda, saying that the group had sought for years to promote a boycott against Israel. Now, the Palestinians are hoping that this report would be helping them to sue Israel for the crimes, not just officials, but also Israeli settlers for the crimes against the people of Palestine.
Okay, thank you for that. Mona Candila, our correspondent in Ramallah. Now, let me invite activist and commentator Brian Turow from Malloy. Good to have you with us. Brian, some argue that Tel Aviv is taking advantage of apartheid to subjugate the Palestinians. Now, do you agree that Israel is practicing apartheid by sweeping movement restrictions of Palestinians, demolishing their homes, denying them building permits, military occupation, land expropriation, also rejection of the residency rights?
Well, of course, yes. And I think I the issue that I take with the Human Rights Watch is that they have said recently that Israel has crossed the threshold to where these have become crimes. And I believe that's happened a long time ago, decades ago. In 2006, former President Jimmy Carter recognized that Israel was an apartheid state and got great approbation for that. So this is a long-standing thing, and it's the difference is not that Israel has somehow crossed a line, a threshold, and become an apartheid state. This is the reality that the people, Palestinian people, have lived in a state of apartheid for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we also have Mick Napier joining us out of Edinburgh. Good to have you with us, Mick. Israeli rights group B'Tselem also published a report last January, and in that it found that the Palestinians that are divided into four tiers of inferior treatment are denied the right to self-determination. Let's have your take.
Well, the report from Human Rights Watch is extremely welcome. It'll certainly shift the balance for those of us who are campaigning for the boycott of Israel. It'll shift the balance inside trade unions and church groups and mosque groups and so on, because it'll give those who are a little bit intimidated by the current Zionist censorship effort, it'll give them confidence and make it more likely that they will come out in support of boycott. Look, this is late, but it's very welcome. It's a little bit like admitting that the sun does indeed rise in the east and sets in the west. It's not the first. I mean, back in 2017, I'm sorry I missed the very first part of this conversation. Correct me if I'm repeating something. But back in 2017, Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley on behalf of the United Nations body representing Western Europe, what people in Europe call the Middle East, came out with a report, a very comprehensive academic report, which was never challenged. The content of it was irrefutable, and it concluded that Israel was an apartheid state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, and it was suppressed by Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN. But the content was never challenged, because how can you challenge the assertion that Israel's an apartheid state when, for Palestinians, the so-called legal system is a meat processing operation where Palestinians are always guilty? Correction, 99.7% of the time they're found guilty by Israeli courts. And Jewish settlers are treated in a radically different manner by the court system. So dual legal system, Palestinian villages being unrecognized by the state, even though those villages are older than the state. I mean, when you look, if you have open eyes, you will conclude that Israel is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians. It's irrefutable. I mean, I doubt very much, sir, that you'll be able to arrange a debate, because I don't see anybody coming onto a public platform and defending the proposition that Israel is not an apartheid state. They'll blare it very loudly from their media, but they cannot defend it in an open platform. And by the way, I hear that not just B'Tselem in Israel, not just Human Rights Watch, but I hear that Amnesty International will shortly follow with the same conclusion. And I think I can hear the sound of a dam breaking. Those of us who have campaigned for decades in arguing that Israel was an apartheid state, indeed, is committing a kind of slow-motion genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, we see public opinion only going one way. And we distinguish between public opinion, which is very receptive to this idea, there's no opposition, and elite and government opinions in the West, which are still trying to, still trying to keep their finger in the dike before it bursts. But burst it will, and the Human Rights Watch report is a roadmap on the way. Can I add one other point that's often lost?
Sure. But
very recently, everybody saw the legal decision, the jury decision in the USA about George Floyd being murdered by the cop, Mr. Chauvin. That verdict was very likely not to have happened without the activity of millions of people in America and around the world campaigning and protesting and arguing that Black Lives Matter. It's the Palestinians who really deserve the credit for this Human Rights Watch decision. It's very slow, it's very late, but it's Palestinian resistance which has changed the mood around the world. And although they can't win against Israeli weapons, they have won the battle for public opinion.
Okay. And now let me ask Brian this. Brian, isn't high time that international engagement toward applying international law and human rights change goalposts rather than considering the two-state solution as sacrosanct?
Yes, it's time that the apartheid state be looked at by the international community. It's time for Israel's nuclear weapons policy that has been off limits to speak about as well, as much taboo as apartheid. These all need to be spoken of. And it is the people, the Palestinians in the streets and the villages who have brought this about. And talk never brings justice all by itself. But we do have to begin speaking about things and calling things by their names before is an essential part of the work for justice. There's much reparation that needs to be done.
Okay, now, Mick, as an occupying force, Tel Aviv has certain responsibilities as regards the Palestinians. The regime not only ignores those functions, it also imposes fishing zone restrictions, making life harder for Palestinian fishermen in Gaza. It puts the Palestinian people's lives in further danger of the COVID pandemic, not to mention the administrative detention and you name it. Let's have your comment.
We don't have time, sir, to go through the list of crimes. We can do an A to Z We can list the crimes against archaeology, where Israel removes any evidence when it possibly can that Palestinians have been the native people there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we can go to Z if we wish. The crimes are inevitable given that Israel is a settler colonial project. I mean, there are harsh regimes around the world. There are murderous dictatorships in Latin America and Myanmar and elsewhere. But very few of them actually wish to remove all of the native people and replace them with incoming colonists from around the world. That's one of the ways in which Israel is unique. And it goes with the territory that you cannot achieve this by soft-soaping the Palestinians, by asking them to leave. It just can't be done except with cruelty, violence, bureaucratic means to make sure they cannot have homes that they need for their families, demolition, shoot to kill, etc., etc. It's A to Z, and you know it cannot be ended unless Zionism is ended. This pernicious creed that some people claim a real estate deal with God from 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and therefore this means that Palestinians have to be driven out of their homes. It's a whole picture, and Israel well knows that it will incur condemnation. The PA Prime Minister, Shtayyeh, has condemned Israel. Could he do otherwise? And probably the EU will follow suit when they see bodies and torture and so on. But this condemnation doesn't mean anything, because as long as the air bridge of weapons and money from Washington and Brussels, it has to be said, to Tel Aviv continues, they know that they can defy world opinion. But yes, the criminality is undeniable. And as I said earlier, the pro-Israel groups will not try to defend this on a level playing field, because it is simply undeniable that Israel is committing grotesque crimes against the people of Palestine. Sadly, my government is arming the criminals.
Brian, would the International Criminal Court be able to run its own investigation in an independent and appropriate way and bring Tel Aviv to justice for all the crimes it's committed?
It will have a lot of obstacles. I don't think the Israeli government is going to be compliant and participate in this, just as the United States has not been compliant about our crimes in Afghanistan and other places. We are bringing sanctions, actually, against the ICC when they threaten to prosecute Americans. So I think we're going to see that same thing. I think the issue about apartheid, though, is very different from even having the longest list of discrete crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, this is systemic. It's institutional.
Right.
This is ensconced in the laws of Israel and in their education. In their economics, it's in their, you know, it's when you say it's an apartheid state, you're not talking about the prejudices and the bigotry and the cruelty of individual people, of thugs doing violence in the street, even though that's a part of it. And Haaretz newspaper yesterday said that the right-wing Jerusalem thugs are an arm of the state. It's the privatization of state violence in the streets. But we're not talking about individual crimes. We're talking about an entire system is imbued with racism. Mm-hmm.
And Mick, what do you think about the ICC? How effective could it be? I mean, if it starts an investigation, even if it's not able maybe to actually bring the perpetrators of the Tel Aviv regime to justice, could it in a way kind of contribute to the Palestinian cause?
I agree very much with your other guest. The ICC will investigate, hopefully, discrete crimes. Even the massacre of 1,000 people is some kind of individual, you know, some kind of discrete crime. The shooting dead, the mass maiming, and so on. These are a litany, but of all sorts of crimes. The thing about apartheid is, I mean, it's defined, forgive me if I've missed this at the start, it's defined by the 2002 Rome Statute of the ICC as similar to other crimes against humanity. It's considered to be a crime against humanity. And now that means that we now begin to consider Israel, and we have to shift the discourse. Israel is not a place of multiple crime scenes, crimes here, crimes there, and so on. Israel is a crime scene, and the crime is apartheid. It's as B'Tselem says, a system of Jewish supremacy over non-Jews. And the proof is indisputable. We now need to carry this argument into civil society around the world. But this decision and this characterization of Israel as an apartheid state will drive the Zionists absolutely crazy, because it definitely shifts the playing field in the direction of the Palestinian people and their supporters around the world. And condemnation of Israel clearly gets you nowhere. It can only be people who are prepared to take action, and that would mean the first governments to begin to implement sanctions against Israel, to tell the ambassadors to leave or to reduce their diplomatic presence there. Mm-hmm. Because it's a lawless, it is a crime scene. And the question of the brutality and the heroism of the Palestinians, but the brutality of the settlers and the police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, fits into this, because they're two arms on the same body. The notion that Israel's a democracy and the official state purveyors of violence will in some way rein in and control Jewish settlers, who are committed, by the way, not just to driving out all Palestinians, but to taking over the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well, destroying it and replacing it with a so-called Third Temple. The idea that these are two different bodies, Israel's a democracy, you cannot be a democracy and an apartheid state. And the sinister division of labour between the settlers being protected by the military is part of that. Can I just share one thing which has really concerned me for the last 20 years since I saw it in Jerusalem? I can't understand, but it's very telling. You see groups of Jews wandering around East Jerusalem with automatic rifles slung over their shoulders. They're not wearing uniforms. They're dressed probably like me or like you. Mm-hmm. But in some mysterious way, the soldiers know that these are armed Jews, and they can move around freely. A Palestinian who might look very similar, if he or she carried a screwdriver, they would be shot dead instantly. But so this apartheid system, this armed groups of Jews terrorizing Palestinians, is so organic. It's right. Built into the system.
Now, Brian, there are also some outside players in this. Let's not focus on Washington-sponsored normalization deals among a number of Arab states and Tel Aviv, and also the so-called deal of the century and the way that they have impacted the Palestinians.
Well, yeah, of course, Washington, the arming of Israel and coming back the other way, United States police officers are being trained by Israeli police and soldiers. You know, the relationship is very close to the point where I feel as an American I'm as responsible for what's going on there as any Israeli, and feel compelled to take action on that. Yes, in the deal of the century, money and weapons can buy a lot, and these connections that are, my heart is not warmed by the United States brokering deals between Bahrain and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Israel and UAE and Israel. This is not does not bode well for the Palestinian people. It has not really. It's been called this deal of the century. Has been called a peace deal, but it really is. It's an armaments deal. It's a deal among gangsters to make sure, as in the words of the Raytheon CEO. Peace doesn't break out in the Middle East anytime soon. To keep it a area of growth for U.S. weapons manufacturers.
Okay. Now, Mick, I got one last question. What's behind the inaction on the part of the European claimants of human rights and international law? Are Palestinians not human beings?
Of course not. Of course not. The legislation, the international law that was passed after World War II at Nuremberg and so on, was horrified at the crimes of the Nazis against Europeans. But those crimes have been committed against Africans and Asians and Americans for hundreds and hundreds of years. They were not supposed to apply to colonial peoples. opposing colonialism. And that's the reality of the situation. My own government, in fact, the Prime Minister Cameron, after the massacre of 2014, thousands of Palestinians slaughtered, he said, this proves how Britain has to stand behind Israel and defend Israel's security. Why is Israel part of the Eurovision Song Contest, part of the European Football League? It is a part of Europe in the sense of a colonial projection of Europe into the Middle East, and it enjoys the support of all the big players in Europe and certainly in North America as an armed, as a substitute double aircraft carrier to chastise any governments that America feels is not being sufficiently obedient. Saudis know that, the Emiratis know that, and they've chosen to ally themselves with America, and therefore to do that you must throw the Palestinians under the bus. But the Palestinians are winning in a very important field, and this Human Rights Watch decision is really a tribute to their resistance, their indomitability.
Okay, and that's when we come to the end of this debate show. We had from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh, and activist and commentator Brian Terror from Mella, Indianapolis.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I did say that it's divided into different parts. Part one, which alhamdulillah we have now finished, explaining and sharing some valuable points about it, was in regards to how one deals with himself, with herself, our relationship with ourselves. In our lives that we have, how do we cater to our own needs and requirements? Entering into part two is how do we deal with other fellow human beings, our relationship with other human beings. Birru al-walidain, being righteous and noble to our parents, it doesn't have an age. It doesn't stop when we become mature or when we become baligh or whatnot. As old as we are, we still need to have that highest level of loyalty and commitment and righteousness towards our parents, and obedience towards our parents. Obeying your parents is obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yes, we understand that when it comes to something like shirk, you don't obey them in that, but you obey them in anything else that they are asking you other than committing a sin. And that's why, you know, that ihsan towards your parents is ihsan towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Being noble to your parents and being good to your parents is being good to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And even if they were to invite you to shirk, you know, the verse says, وَإِن جَاهَدَاكَ عَلَىٰ أَن تُشْرِكَ بِي مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ. If they were to ask you or invite you to do shirk in me, then فَلَا تُطِعْهُمَا, don't obey them in that. Then it says, وَصَاحِبُهُمَا فِي الدُّنْيَا مَعْرُوفًا, but continue to accompany them. صَاحِبْهُمَا فِي الدُّنْيَا مَعْرُوفًا, continue to accompany them in the good way possible, in the best way possible. مَعْرُوفًا. And of course, clearly this is an invitation to us that, you know, whether they are alive, whether they are dead, whether they are Muslim, whether they are not Muslim, whether they are practicing any religion or not practicing any religion, we still need to see them as an authority, to revere them, to respect them.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih ul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih ul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Maybe one parent poisoned you against the other parents. Maybe one parent did indeed do wrong to you and abandon you, and maybe, for example, hit you or do certain things that they probably should not have done. But here, this is where your nobility, that level of nobility, comes into practice, where we can understand that thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is through thanking them. If you thank your parents, you are thanking Allah. If you thank Allah, you are doing so through thanking your parents. We know the ayah, فَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍّ. The ayah says, "Uff." The word "uff" is this least form of objection. The least form of objection. That you are objecting to your parents, what your parents are saying. And in the many, many ahadith that